When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to Peoples and Things, a podcast about human life with technology. I'm your host, Lee Vinsel, an associate professor of science, technology, and society at Virginia Tech. You can reach me with comments and suggestions at leevinsel@gmail.com or on Twitter at STS_news. I would love to hear from you. What is technology? I need to ask that question from beneath the weight of the historical import of its cosmic bigness. What is technology? Gotta hate that question. I've spent a goodly portion of my life avoiding it. If it comes up on campus, I walk out of the room. What is technology? So much ink spilled over that one, and it's gotten us pretty close to nothing. Though I do like Paul Nightingale's essay, What is Technology? 6 Definitions and 2 Pathologies. That's a good one. What is technology? Historian David Edgerton has argued that we should just stop using the word altogether unless the people we are studying are using it, and then we can quote them. When it comes to historical writing, I think that's the way to go. Otherwise, we just end up importing our assumptions into other eras. But for a variety of reasons, I don't find I can ditch the word technology in many areas of my working life. And you could say for better or worse, but mostly it's for the worse. We do know that answers to the question, what is technology, can go very wrong, though often when they do, it's not because of thinking has gone off the rails, it's because of unthinking. It's because people aren't thinking at all. They're just making assumptions built on popular opinions and ways of talking. This is what people in my line of work find, for example, in undergraduate classrooms when initially students talk as if technology is reducible to smartphones and apps and the internet and stuff like that. That is unthinking in action. I'm interested in tools. I'm interested in how human and non-human animals refashion their environments to achieve their ends. I love the episode we did with archaeologist Kate Freeman on the archaeology of innovation. We should have more archaeologists on here. I want to think about the material realities of ancient peoples. I also want to think about why the pace of material change on the planet picked up like 150 or 200 years ago. Hint, it's called capitalism. Capitalism. But don't let anyone tell you that technology is changing faster than it ever has before. That is complete bullshit. But if we're going to do a historical or sociological study of a technology, once it has slipped into the background, once it has become what scholars call everyday or ordinary or mundane, we have lots of words for this, how do we study things once they are no longer getting so much attention? Well, today's guest, Andrew Simon, a senior lecturer in Middle Eastern Studies at Dartmouth College, has a neat set of answers for us in his book, Media of the Masses, Cassette Culture in Modern Egypt. Media of the Masses tracks how tape players and cassettes became interwoven with Egyptian culture beginning in the 1970s. The book is cool for several reasons. On the simplest level, it's just full of neat stories, but most of all, I appreciate it for the way it uses multiple kinds of sources to approach different aspects of what may first appear to be a non-glamorous technology. Though, as we'll see, the tape players were markers of social class, so there was initially a kind of glamour to them. I think Professor Simon gives us a lot to chew on when it comes to approaching everyday technologies and how to find them in historical records. I had a lot of fun chatting with Andrew. I think you're going to have a lot of fun listening to him. Hey, get excited! Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today, man.
Thanks so much for having me on the podcast. I appreciate it.
So the book is really neat in a number of ways, and I can't wait to get into it with you. When you explain to people what it's about, what do you say and what were you trying to do with it?
Yeah, great question. So I was trying to tell the surprising story of a familiar technology. So looking at a technology that we often consider to be very ordinary in nature, and exploring its extraordinary impact. So rather than looking at the invention of cassette technology, something that has been documented pretty extensively, is well known, I wanted to consider what happens once cassette technology moves from being this idea to being an actual object. What happens when it leaves the walls of its workshop in Europe and it ends up in a place like Egypt?
Mm-hmm. How'd you come to write this book?
Yeah, so it's been a journey, as is the case with many books. So I think one of the initial inspirations happened in 2011. So a year after, or within a matter of weeks after graduating from undergrad in North Carolina, I flew to Cairo for this intensive Arabic fellowship. It happened to overlap with the Egyptian Revolution in 2011. I was taking classes in Tahrir Square, which is the epicenter of those million-person mass demonstrations, ended up missing a lot of class.
No way. I can't believe it.
Attended those protests, those 18 days leading up to the downfall of this dictator who had been in power for 30 years.
Yeah.
And those events really opened my ears to the importance of sound, pop culture, and mass media. And so then I left Egypt for grad school in a much less revolutionary place, Ithaca, New York, closer to Canada than New York City. And there I began to explore all these topics further. So I wrote something on popular music. I wrote something on this one artist that challenged the stories that the Egyptian government was telling. I wrote something on Muslim preachers. And when it came time for the dissertation that would eventually, through many revisions, become this book later on, I was looking for a common thread, and that thread became cassettes. And then that's when I really set out to explore this further and returned back to Egypt to do so.
When did you make the decision to focus on cassettes? Where were you at in that process? It sounds like you were writing and working for a while before you came to that. Is that right?
Yeah, so those papers were just kind of seminar papers for particular classes. So like a class on Islamic oral culture, a class on Middle East soundscapes, a class on Middle East politics.
Yeah.
And when I saw that that thread was cassettes at the time, I thought, okay, I'm going to write a history of cassette technology. But then when I went to Egypt and I started reading all these popular magazines, which were almost like a cross for listeners in the U.S. between something like Newsweek and People or something like that. I started seeing cassettes in all these different places, like cassettes and reports on black markets, cassettes and reports on mass migration in the 70s and 80s. And it was at that point that I thought, this is not a history of cassette technology. This is a history of Egypt through the window of its cassette culture then.
That's cool, man. And, you know, the Arab Spring, Egyptian Revolution, these things were also... There was so much about like social media in this. And later, I think it turned out to be like way overly simple, the initial narrative. But I just wondered, like, did you immediately have reaction to that kind of media and revolution take on things?
Yes, absolutely. Because there was so much writing that was coming out at the time when I was in Cairo, also in the square, personally witnessing things. And you would have people, especially in Western media outlets, calling what was happening in Egypt a Facebook revolution, a Twitter revolution.
Yeah.
And so you have social media being so overstated, its influence, and also very romanticized. I mean, one example of this is Mubarak and the Egyptian government. They actually shut down the internet in the course of those protests, and the protests continue to grow. More and more people turn out. So without Twitter, it's not like people weren't turning out in the streets and putting their bodies, their lives on the line. And so that's something that I also wanted to push back on in the case of this book. Because when it comes to the Middle East, like so often, the only media that matters is the most recent media, social media. Yeah. So I wanted to question kind of the newness of this new media. Look at an earlier time. In many ways, cassettes were the internet before the internet. I see the internet as like an iteration of the cassette tape going back decades.
Right. You know, it's totally fascinating. And we're going to get into that in a couple different ways. I had a random question for you. Have you ever looked at the sociologist Daniel Lerner's studies of radio adoption in the Middle East? Have you ever bumped into these?
No.
Oh, I mean, it would be fun to take a look at it with you together at some point, because I think they were a product of that BASR, like social research place at Columbia, and it's very trapped up in modernization studies. You know, it's all about, like, I think it's called The Decline of Traditional Society or some shit like that, right? Which is like what you'd get from these mid-century modernist kind of guys. But I also think there's like interesting empirical work they're up to, like actually looking at it. But that's a long way to set up. Tell me a bit about radio there, because you talk about, like, there was this earlier moment of radio where it seemed like it could have been, I don't know what word to use here, man, like democratizing, or it could have been a more open thing, but it closes down pretty fast.
Yeah, so something that is important in the case of radio when it comes to Egypt is that radio had been state controlled since the 1930s. So very early on, you would have individuals operating their own radio stations, but then due to the limitations of the technology at that point, they would reach listeners only within their immediate vicinity. The audiences were quite limited. The Egyptian government steps in, takes control of the radio then in the early to mid 1930s. And then by the time of the period I'm looking at in the 70s and 80s going forward, we actually have different, this is going to sound very Orwellian, but different committees operating within state-controlled Egyptian radio, screening everything. So we have a text committee where artists would bring the lyrics to a song to this committee. They would review it. And then if they allowed it to go forward, people would end up recording it. The recording would then go to a listening committee. These were the titles of the actual committee. They would listen to the recording. If they advanced it, this is a very small number that are making it through these two committees, it would end up with a radio station. The radio station would then decide if it wanted to permit it. And then it would be broadcast to people in Egypt and beyond. Wow. So you have a very, very minuscule pool of elite artists who are actually reaching a mass audience. And of course, cassette tapes, they upend all of this. Because anyone can record their voice and reach a mass audience then.
Never say that artists don't employ people, I guess, in that circuit. If there's all these committees, I mean, there's money moving for suppression, I guess.
Some of these artists, to that point, sat on these committees and censored other artists. So artists that were actually profiting off of state-controlled radio, when cassettes come about, all of a sudden they're calling for greater censorship because they're losing out financially to all of these upstart artists who are, you know, quote unquote, not qualified. To be able to reach people.
Monopolies, man. So, I mean, you have a neat section in the intro that deals with the issue of sources. So, I mean, like, it's such a, it's one of these things. I recently had a historian, Mia Bay, who wrote Traveling Black, and she follows black people across different transit modes. It hasn't been published yet, but the episode's coming. And you're doing something similar, right? You're following a you're not following a people or a population across technologies. You're following this technology through all these different spaces of culture, right? So how did you think about sources and how to get your stories?
Yeah, so the idea of sources and archives were really important, I would say, in the case of this project, because when it comes to Egypt, the period I'm looking at, people do not have access to the Egyptian National Archives. So one of the things that I had to do in this book is to really try to write a history of Egypt without its national archives. Mm-hmm. And to do that, I had to rely upon a lot of different materials, like films, memoirs, social media posts, actual cassette recordings, the jackets mm-hmm. that were encasing those cassettes, cassette catalogs, personal photographs that once were in family albums that disintegrated in the 70s, ended up in garbage bags and paper markets in the 2000s when I was doing this work, those popular magazines, oral interviews. And so basically all these things in my mind kind of came together to construct what I call Egypt's shadow archive. So mm-hmm. these materials that exist in the shadow of the inaccessible national archives that provide us with a really vibrant picture of the past, as opposed to what a select number of people deemed worthy of conserving and then continue to police in the present, because historical research in Egypt is a matter of national security.
I'm sure that's
true. And unless we look beyond the national archives, we end up ceding control and understanding of the past to people that are actively trying to accomplish that. And so that was also one of the objectives in the book, in the story.
Well, you know, and I mean, the Egyptian context is fascinating, and it really draws out this issue. But I actually think the problem of like technology and an adoption of and use and how we study that is pretty deep too, right? So like, you know, if I'm thinking about this with computers right now in like the 80s and 90s, I mean, we have the histories of the technologies, like in your story, right? But like how technology adoption actually looked in middle class and other kinds of households is much harder to get at, right? And so I actually thought your book was kind of cool methodologically in that way too. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I wanted to do is look beyond the invention of technologies to technologies in action. So like when it comes to cassette technology, okay, we have this guy Lew Ottens and Phillips, they introduced the first compact cassette. This happens in 63. It's a breakthrough. It's smaller, cheaper, easier to use than the reel-to-reel recorder. And that's usually like the entire story of cassette technology. That was a starting point for the story. Like what happens after this exists? Because it ends up having an impact with its users that Lew Ottens never could have imagined or envisioned. And if we look beyond the invention of these things to like how these things are operating in action, all of a sudden the history of technology, it's a global field.
Like it just explodes the boundaries of it. Amen, man. And the book you write, in focusing on the social life of a single mass medium, this book presents a panoramic history of the modern nation through the lens of an everyday technology. And then you organize each of the chapters around one of six themes: consumption, law, taste, circulation, history, and archives. And I thought that was really interesting. I mean, you could have done a chronological story, and there is some chronology. You're not like James Joyce here in Finnegan's Wake. I mean, it's not jumping all over the place, right? I mean, it moves through time, but you're also doing these kind of thematic structures. And I wondered, like, you know, why did you choose to structure the book in that way? It was cool.
Yeah, thank you. I almost envisioned the book actually as a mixtape. Like,
Each
chapter in my head, like when I was kind of structuring this, is almost like a track. And that's why they're thematic in nature. And the first two chapters or tracks, it's all about like, how did cassette culture come to be in Egypt? What is the advent? What is the starting point for this story? And then the four chapters that follow are all about the impact of the technology and its users. So we have that bit when it comes to taste, that's not like tasting food. That's like public taste of that. So we have that's on the creation of culture. Uh-huh. The next one is on how culture moves. And then that chapter on history is about what happens when these two things collide, like the circulatory potential and the creative power of cassette technology. What happens when they converge in the case of one artist who challenges the government stories? And then that final bit on archives is like, what remains of cassette culture in Egypt? So this was a story that I didn't want to tell chronologically. Yeah. Like it moves across decades. And I really wanted to, you know, dive into these bigger ideas and think about like, how can media technologies more broadly, writ large, outside of Egypt, outside of Middle East studies, how can they tell larger stories? How can they lead us to rethink the histories of nations? How could we do more with media history? Something that I wanted to do in this book.
Can you say a bit about how you think about causality in technology? Because it's, in a way, it's about the effects of like the adoption of technology or something like that. And you're really, in the whole story, we're going to get into it here in a second, is about the power of the people, right? Is about of the masses. And so, how do you think about like, you know, determinism and like the role of technology in the picture?
Yeah, really against technological determinism, because we see a lot of that also in the Arab Spring and in social media, hearkening back to that, where we had, you know, like the Facebook brought down the Egyptian government and stuff like that. Yes. And so something that I'm really careful of, even in the course of this research, but in the writing up of it also, is to point out like cassettes don't do anything on their own. They're objects. Yeah. They don't have their own agency. So it's how are people wielding them? Yeah. And using them to different ends. Because in many cases, we also have state-sanctioned artists who are taking advantage of cassette tapes too. Like everything appears on these cassette recordings. Right. We have those state-sanctioned voices. We have Madonna. We have the Beatles. We have Muslim preachers. We have Egyptian popular music, hip-hop, jazz, personal messages. All of this stuff ends up on these recordings because people are harnessing them for different purposes.
Yeah. That's right, man. I gotta say, with the mixtape thing, you briefly took me back to like my first girlfriends there for a second. So like there was a bit of a trip. So, you know, you're writing this book, as you well know, for like audiences that probably don't know a lot about the recent history of Egypt. So like, what did you find necessary to kind of like get on the table to kind of like tell the story you wanted to tell about what was happening in Egypt and how cassettes fit in that those changes?
Yeah, sure. I mean, one of the fun things, going back to your mention of your first girlfriend, is that a lot of people know and have dealt with and have used cassette technology in their lives. Perhaps with the exception of my students, where I'm like, this is a cassette tape. This was like social media, but decades before. So we have this nostalgic element and this familiarity with cassette tapes, but we have this very different context in the case of Egypt. So when I'm introducing that, I mean, some important things there is like, this is a major moment in Egypt's modern history, that's often only like a few sentences when it comes to works on the Arab Spring and on those demonstrations. So I wanted to take something that's often like a footnote in those books and make it the central subject of the study. And when it comes to this period, the 70s, 80s moments in particular, this is something that's often kind of approached through people writing on very big momentous events. Yeah. Things like the 1973 war in Egypt.
Yep.
We also have like, how did authoritarian regimes come to be and strengthen themselves and consolidate authority? And then we have Islam, religion. This is the moment of the Islamic revival in the Middle East. I wanted to like flip the script on all those things. So I wanted to look at mundane things, things like music. I wanted to look at people challenging these regimes rather than the people responsible for creating them. And then I wanted to really listen beyond Islam, beyond religion. Think about other sounds, because they were only a fraction of the things circulating in Egypt's soundscape. And it's at this point in time where we also have like Egypt's economic opening, it's called, where we have this shift from state-sponsored socialism to Western open-door capitalism. This is also the moment of the oil boom. And one of the outcomes of this is we have Egyptians going all across the Middle East to work abroad, earn higher wages, return back home. And one of the things they return with is the dual cassette player. And so the oil boom is actually in part responsible for the advent of cassette culture in Egypt. So we have this very kind of vibrant moment that I wanted to dive into through the window then of cassette technology.
That's cool, man. You talk about Sadat plays a role in this moment, this opening, right? This is what he's the president of Egypt.
He is, and he's the architect of the opening.
Okay, so you talk about how adoption of cassette tapes, I quote, coincided with the creation of a wider culture of consumption under Sadat. So, end quote there. What do you mean by that? And start to spell out a bit more about like the role of this in consumerism and such.
Sure. So in the aftermath of that 73 war, we have Sadat announce the Infitah, this economic opening. And this also coincides with that oil boom. So we have an unprecedented number of Egyptians who become economic migrants, who go to places like Libya, Iraq, the Gulf more broadly, go work over there, earn higher wages, send some of that money back home, but also return home with things, with objects. Mm-hmm. And then this engenders really this broader culture of mass consumption, where we also have foreign funding coming in from the West. We have all these international companies, Samsung, Toshiba, Sony. Yeah. They all start to have licensed agents in Egypt. Mm-hmm. And for the first time, all of a sudden, this idea of the modern home, what mm-hmm. it means for a home to be modern, is less about the occupants of that home and their education, more about the objects mm-hmm. in that home. So we have this thing that's happening where it's almost like the materialization of modernity, or what it means to be modern. Yep. More people are buying more things than ever before. And one of the things they're buying the most are cassette players and cassette tapes. So these two things are happening simultaneously. Cassette culture is taking off at the same exact moment that mass consumer culture is taking off as well.
That's so cool, man. And one of the neat things you do in that chapter is you unpack as in a kind of analytical way to photograph. So tell us about a photograph and, you know, how'd you find it and what'd you see in it?
Yeah, so I love this. So this is why when I'm on social media and I have like my wife looking over my shoulder or my students and they think I'm not working, I'm working. This is all research. Every minute I spend on Facebook is for research purposes, naturally.
Oh, I like where this is going.
And so there's a number of Facebook groups, Egyptian Facebook groups, where we have thousands of photographs from all different time periods. And there's a lot of nostalgia behind these different images and the comments on them. And so I'm on one of these pages one day, and I find this image of these three guys basically posing with a cassette radio, almost as if they were in a studio. It's very formal in nature, and the only object is this cassette radio, one of the guy's laps, two other people behind him, hands on the shoulder. And so I'm wondering, like, what is going on with this image? Because the caption for it is like, soon the iPhone 6 will become as antiquated as this cassette radio.
That was what
it was put up as. And so I was like, what is going on here? Who are these people? Where was this photo taken? Because none of this information is available on the image or in the caption for it. So then someone comments on this photo, oh, I actually knew those guys. And I was like, what?
Holy shit.
So I have to reach out to this person naturally, send them a completely blind Facebook message. And they're like, oh yeah, that was a relative who had gone to Iraq. He had worked in this small village during that 70s-80s major oil boom migration moment. And his prized purchase was a cassette radio. And he was so proud of this purchase that he went with his friends to this portrait studio where we have one of those big like box cameras, throw the curtain over your head, like snap the light bulb camera. Takes this picture of them posing with the cassette radio, with which he then returns to Egypt. Because this object, it also indexed and served as evidence of one's upward social and economic mobility. Of one's new purchasing power.
Right. Yeah.
And so when people like went abroad during this moment, Egyptians bought always two things, or they strove to. One was an electric fan, and one was the cassette radio. And so this is like where this story begins, the story of mass migration, the story of mass consumer culture, the story of Egyptians traveling to all these places and then returning to Egypt with these objects. And that photo kind of encapsulated all of that. This image appears, you know, like 40 years later. That was an image in someone's probably family album going back to the 70s.
Yeah. Well, man, if you're going to buy something, a box fan and a cassette player sounds pretty good to me, actually, as like starting objects. So then in the next chapter, you turn to smuggling and cassette tapes. And this is, I also thought this was really neat on a kind of source base or method base, just because you're mining like crime reports and other kinds of stuff. How did you get onto this? And why are people smuggling cassette tapes so much?
Yeah, so, I mean, great question. In the case of smuggling and also theft, these are kind of two threads that I look at and what I like to call the criminal biography of cassette technology. And this really came to my attention because I was reading these popular magazines, and I basically, these magazines were weekly, and I read every issue over the course of 20 years, two different magazines, which was a lot of issues. Yeah. I have like an iPhoto library of over 30,000 images, and those are just relevant images to this book. And so one of the things I saw in these magazines that I never knew about before looking at them were like all of these sad criminals, like in quotes, posing with like a dozen cassette radios, like often in handcuffs or very melancholic in nature. And it was in the crime of the week section of these periodicals. And I was like, what is going on here? Like, what are all these cassette radios doing with this one individual? Yeah. And so then I started reading these stories, and they were written almost like detective stories about how the police, you know, were so brilliant and they worked together seamlessly. Oh, their coordination was perfect. And then they apprehended this dangerous criminal who had stolen 20 cassette radios, and he was no longer a threat to society. You know, kudos to the police. Pat us on the shoulder. And so these stories, they were glorifying the security sector in Egypt. But one of the things that they inadvertently end up doing is revealing this thriving black market for cassette technology, because no one dude needs 20 cassette radios. And so these individuals are stealing all of these objects because they're then hawking them and selling them. So these stories that are supposed to glorify the police actually end up revealing the shortcomings of policing. And so we have cassette radios being stolen from cars, homes, stores, but then we also have people smuggling the technology across Egypt's national borders. So smuggling in the case of putting it in suitcases and hoping that customs don't find them, bringing them aboard ships from places as far away as Europe, across the Mediterranean. And you have people who are actually like suitcase traders, is the term in Arabic, that are returning with a ton of objects with the sole intention of then selling them. But they end up like announcing them as, oh, they're gifts to family members, or they're all for me.
Right, right.
And then they end up like opening a boutique or something like that. And cassette technology, unlike, let's say, a television set or other objects, really lends itself to this because it's incredibly small. Like tapes could fit in your pocket, but players could even fit in a bag.
Totally.
And this becomes very, very difficult for authorities to police and becomes very problematic, especially when cassette recordings are being smuggled out of Egypt with voices that the government then doesn't want to be heard.
So how did you think use and adoption of taste end up reshaping taste? And we are talking about like preferences here rather than like the taste buds in our mouths. How does it end up reshaping things?
Yes, it did not make everyone like less inclined to eat raisins or something like that.
Yes.
And so in terms of public taste and like these sensibilities, I mean, something to think about here is like, what is the purpose of culture? What is the objective of culture? And from the perspective of the Egyptian government, it's really all about enlightening, educating, and making model citizens. And so prior to the advent of this cassette culture, and even throughout, we have all these different initiatives from state-controlled radio that we talked about to even this initiative called public culture, which is not an idea. It's like a state-engineered program that was charged with erasing what the government called cultural illiteracy in Egypt. So we have the government setting up culture centers, clubs, traveling caravans that would like go out into the Egyptian countryside and stage Shakespearean plays to like uplift and enlighten the masses. With cassette technology, due to its affordability, its ability to circulate, but its usability, first and foremost, anyone can create culture for the first time ever. This is not something social media does. This is something cassette technology does, going back to the 70s. So all of a sudden, anyone becomes a cultural producer instead of a consumer. And then this sparks tremendous anxiety on the part of local authorities who can all of a sudden no longer control what Egyptian culture means and what it comprises. And then this inspires this whole discussion around the contamination of taste, the end of Egyptian culture, the downfall of music.
Because
all of a sudden you have these working class people who are no longer just listening to what others choose for them to listen to. They are recording themselves, creating entire new genres, and it creates this panic. Much like we even see now in the case of, there's this thing called mahraganat music in Egypt, took off after the Arab Spring, was made by primarily working class Egyptians through the internet, and then traveled on flash drives. None of that stuff is new. This was all happening decades earlier with popular music and cassette tapes in the 70s.
That's hilarious, man. I didn't know that, like, people worried about media ruining culture before TikTok. No, that's news to me.
There's an older story there. And you also, by the way, you have people saying things like, the content that were on some of these cassettes were more dangerous than cocaine. These are statements people are saying back in the 70s. And then going with this new musical genre, like only over the past few years, you have people saying, oh, that genre is more dangerous than COVID. And so all of this language, it's like just being recycled over the years. Culture is always in a state of perpetual degradation.
Yes, and crisis. I mean, cultural pessimists have been around forever, right? And they're like, so we haven't fallen off a cliff yet, but the meme remains. So we'll see. So, you know, I gathered from your intro that if people have written about cassettes before in Egypt, it's often focused on religion and sermons. I just wondered, that made me wonder just like, if we have any sense, and I can imagine this would be pretty hard, of like what percentages different genres and forms like took up of the overall mix, and whether it's different than the States or place, you know, Europe or whatever.
Sure. I mean, in terms of that content, I think that's absolutely correct. So a few people, when they have written on cassettes, if they've given any attention to the technology, it's often been in the case of Islamic sounds. And that's something true with the study of sound even more broadly in the case of the Middle East. So we have a wonderful book called The Ethical Soundscape, written by Charles Hirschkind, who's an anthropologist who goes to Cairo and looks at Islamic sermons and how they were circulating, creating these counterpublics, challenging these official discourses of religion. We also have a case study that may be familiar to some listeners. We have the 79 Iranian Revolution, Khomeini recording on cassette tapes, those cassette tapes making their way back to Iran, around Iran, playing a part in challenging the Shah's government. Huh. In the case of what's actually on cassettes, though, in Egypt, Islamic sounds and sermons are only a fraction, a tiny fraction of the material that's circulating. And so someone may be like in a cab in the 70s or 80s, even into the 90s and early 2000s, because cassettes have a very long life in Egypt. They're not replaced by CDs or something like that.
Yeah.
People could be listening to an Islamic sermon, then they listen to Michael Jackson, then they listen to the Beatles, then they listen to, you know, Egyptian popular music, then they listen to a singer from the Gulf, then they listen to a recording that they made to a lover or something. Like,
people
were listening to all of these things. So I wanted to explode this idea that basically equates acoustic culture in Egypt and in the Middle East, more broadly, with Islam. Yeah. There's much more going on there that I wanted to unpack.
No, I totally agree that you should. And I, you know, the other thing is that I feel like the things I bumped into that talk about that, like, fail to capture how much of that goes on in the States, too. I mean, you know, Christian, Catholics, Protestants, woo-woo, tantric yoga folks. Like, you know, there's all these different, like, spiritual people are using cassettes and the tapes or cassettes to get ideas around from probably the 70s forward or whenever, right? So, I mean, I don't know. There's just this weird, like, exceptionalism about it in the Middle East where it's like they're using it for religious purposes. And it's like, look at your neighbor and their, like, weird collection of woo-woo stuff that they hide from you and you don't know it, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, this idea of, like, there's some weird exceptionalism there, that could be said about, like, everything, like, everyone ever thought about the Middle East, including cassette culture, though. Yeah. And of course, like, you have people that are traveling, like, from Egypt to the U.S., bringing their tapes there. So these tapes are moving beyond borders and then vice versa. They're traveling everywhere. Like, cassette culture is a global culture.
Yeah.
And so that is evident also in the case that people are listening to in Egypt. Like, I have a tape behind me right now. If people see the video, where there's a soundtrack to a Bollywood movie that has been recorded over with Quranic recitation. And so, like, we have all of these sounds that are moving about and being heard.
Yeah, that's cool, man. And that does connect to the next chapter I wanted to talk to you about, which is, like, copying culture. So, like, you know, obviously a lot of this focuses on piracy, you know, which makes sense. That was a famous problem with cassettes everywhere. But it goes a lot broader than that. So, like, what do we know about copying sounds?
Yeah, so piracy, I mean, one of the things that happens with cassettes in Egypt is it fundamentally and radically changes the circulation of culture. And so piracy, for the first time, becomes a popular practice as a result of cassette tapes. And we have all these different forms of piracy that play out in Egypt that I tried to map out. So we have like personal piracy that people are familiar with, that many of us probably even committed ourselves. And so we have like people taking a Beethoven tape and recording over it with this singer that was considered to be incredibly vulgar in Egypt. Or we have that Bollywood tape becoming Quranic recitation. Like no one was immune to being erased and replaced when it came to these recordings. We also have state piracy. This was very interesting that I encountered for the first time in these magazines, where we have employees for state-controlled Egyptian radio that are recording radio broadcasts illegally onto cassette tapes and then selling the cassette tapes to people in and outside of Egypt. And then we have international piracy, where we have sounds that are being produced in Egypt that are being pirated at a distance from it. Like we have this very famous example. I'll just share like one vignette where we have this religious authority travel from Egypt to the US to recite the Quran in Congress. And he actually meets with Jimmy Carter, who's president at the time. Carter says, "Oh, I really love your voice." This guy says, "Oh, wonderful. I'll send you some tapes when I get back to Egypt." He gets on a flight from DC to Chicago, picks up a copy of the Chicago Tribune, and sees that his tapes are for sale in the US already, unbeknownst to him, because they're being pirated.
Oh, and so, man,
we have all these steps to try to bring an end to piracy. Like we have the creation of the cassette police. This is an actual police unit in Egypt that is supposed to go around and identify these fraudulent tapes when they receive a phone call, basically from people who dialed a number that was also put on cassette jackets. Like, if this tape is fraudulent, because you know, because the color of the tape is blue and it's supposed to be green or something like that, call the cassette police. And they, like, will rush to you. This obviously failed, like, spectacularly.
Yeah.
And so you also have people, like, writing other things on cassette jackets. One of the best ones that I found was actually for, like, this Islamic recording, where you have this label say, like, if this tape is fraudulent, or if you yourself commit cassette piracy, this actually runs against the tenets of Islam. And by the way, proceeds from this tape are going towards supporting Egyptian orphans. So you also would be robbing from them. And so you have these companies that are trying to like turn consumers into informants.
Yeah.
Because they are losing out financially to all these people pirating tapes. And this proves impossible to stop globally, more broadly. Piracy is just taking off everywhere in and outside of Egypt.
This is the first time I had to do this. I'm going to go grab a source over here, though. Give me one second.
Okay.
All right. Don't usually have show and tell of any sort. So you have a chapter called Subverting that, among other things, examines this song Nixon Baba, or Father Nixon.
Yes.
So tell us about Nixon Baba.
Okay. So this is maybe my favorite part of the book. So this chapter revolves around this event where we have Nixon travel to Egypt in the summer of 74 during the throes of Watergate. And this is part of this broader tour for peace in the Middle East. So we have him go to Egypt, Saudi Arabia, elsewhere. And basically the Egyptian government welcomes Nixon with open arms. So they like shut down the airport. They roll out an actual red carpet for him. Sadat greets him. An honor guard like fires off this gun salute. They get into this jet black convertible. And then they travel as part of this caravan of 200 vehicles that goes throughout the streets of Cairo and arrives at this palace. And they're moving down like these roadways that had just been straightened by bulldozers for the sole purpose of this visit. They're passing under these archways that were erected solely to welcome Nixon. And you have people shouting things like, "Welcome Nixon, long live Nixon, we trust Nixon." And then all of this fanfare inspires this song called Nixon Baba, or Father Nixon, which is this poem that's penned by this guy, Ahmed Fuad Nigam, and is then set to song by this other individual, Sheikh Imam, who was blind and was an oud player. And in this song, they basically completely undermine the official story of the visit as told by the Egyptian government. And so they do this in a few different ways. Like Sheikh Hamam, he alludes to Nixon's woes back in the U.S. He talks about his frail state. He discusses the possibility of him being no longer around. He says he's not going to greet Nixon out of ignorance. And then he compares his visit in Egypt to two different things. So one of them is, it's called the Zar in Arabic. It's like a ceremony for excising spirits. Mm-hmm. And he basically says that Sadat, the Egyptian president, is like the leader of this ceremony. He also refers to him as the devil. And then he talks about all of the Egyptian government officials being convulsing whores and marching along in lines during this parade. He also then compares it to a wedding procession in which Nixon plays the part of a groom that no one wanted to marry, that someone married as a last resort.
I mean, not wrong.
and when he's singing this, by the way, in the cassette recordings that continue to exist to this day, and if some of them have made their way online, you could hear them on YouTube in places, Imam actually spits on Nixon in the recordings.
Wow.
And so this track is traveling on non-commercial cassettes. Like, their songs, more broadly, were never sold on tapes released by official recording labels.
Right.
They were never available in stores. They were never sold at kiosks. They were copied and moved about through private parties where people would go to their apartment. They would go to another apartment, invite them over to their living room, record them on a cassette player, pirate the tape, distribute it amongst everyone. Or they were recorded at political protests where they would perform prior to the police arriving and arresting them and imprisoning them multiple times and shutting down those events. And through that circulation then, like, we have the story that Sadat is trying to tell completely being destroyed. And some of the interesting things about that is, like, Sadat and his later biography, when he's reflecting on Nixon's visit, because Nixon leaves Egypt and resigns 2 months later before Nixon comes
really
to Watergate.
Good, right?
So Nixon's like, thank you, Sadat, for this lavish welcome. I will be sure to have you to the White House, except Nixon's no longer in the White House 2 months later because of Watergate, right? So when Sadat is looking back on this event that he spent so much time on and so much money in planning, and in his memoir, it gets one sentence. It is, Nixon came to Egypt and his visit preceded a terrible whirlpool of political turmoil in the U.S. And so he's actively trying to forget, but this song won't let him forget because it continues to circulate and it's revived all the way up to the Arab Spring. Another photograph on social media. Last thing I'll say here is we have an image that was one of the official images, part of the official story of the visit, where we have Nixon and Sadat and the jet black Cadillac convertible moving down these streets with We Trust Nixon banners. And the caption for the photograph on Facebook, this was uploaded within the past year or two, says, American President Richard Nixon's visit to Egypt in 74, for which Sheikh Hamam sang, welcome Father Nixon. And so here we have official image, but this unofficial soundtrack has become the official anthem and the enduring memory of that event.
Wow. I just thought I would read the first verse because I feel like this is something worth giving people a taste of. So it's, welcome Father, this is the English translation, obviously. Welcome Father Nixon, OU Watergate. They have honored your arrival, the sultans of beans and oil. They have rolled out the red carpet for you from Ras Al Tin to Mecca. And from there, you will pass through Acre, or is it Acre, which means
Acre,
do the impossible. And they'll say you made the pilgrimage. Round and round the never-ending mulud goes, O family of the prophet, give us your blessings. It doesn't sound like a very happy take on these things, huh?
No, and it's like dripping in sarcasm and biting criticism. And so many of those words have double meanings. And it also has a certain cadence. Like even the beginning of the song in Arabic, it's Sharaftia Nixon Baba, Yabata al Watergate, Amalulik Iwa Sima, Salatina al Ful wa Zait, Farshulik Osa Sikka, Marasatina la Mecca, Wahanaak Tenzel Alaka wa Bulu Lake Hagate. And then it goes on and continues. So
we have like these rhyming
couplets. And when they're performing this, they are laughing on the track, laughing at Nixon. And because these were recorded at private events, you hear the greater laughter because it's picking up conversations.
Wow,
it's picking up all these jokes. I encourage everyone to go out and listen.
That's awesome. I also just wanted to like do a little aside here and say there's this appendix. I was reading from the appendix where you have some songs and poems. And, you know, the first one, A Little Bit Up, A Little Bit Down, it reminded me of this old Nick Cave song I love called From Her to Eternity. Of course, Nick Cave makes it real nasty and it gets weird because it's Nick Cave. But I don't know. There's this like guy downstairs and there's this beautiful woman upstairs who he's drawn to, or maybe it's the other way around. Anyway, it's just a very lovely little poem or song. So what are there others in the appendix that you really liked? I was really glad you included them.
Yeah, so the guy that sings that song also sings one other that's in the book too. His name was Ahmed Adawiya, and he was a pioneer of popular music in Egypt, which is this genre where we have people singing about everyday things in Egyptian colloquial Arabic. Like, so for those of you who like may not know out there, we basically have two different registers of Arabic. We have modern standard Arabic, which is kind of like Shakespearean English. Okay. And then we have dialects in all these countries, which is like the English that you and I, Lee, are like talking it right now for the podcast. Right. So most people prior to this performed in modern standard Arabic, which is a bit disconnected from people's like lived realities and the language they're used to. And Adawiya then is singing in like all these everyday phrases about everyday stuff. Like he has a song about traffic that went massively viral on cassettes. Yes. He has this song about like looking this like woman like up and down. But at the same time, the song could also be like a commentary on class and like growing divisions between the haves and the have-nots in Egypt during this period. And so you have, of course, critics saying, hell no, he's like looking this woman up and down. This is entirely unacceptable. Right. And then you have people being like, oh, this is actually an astute commentary on Egypt's economic opening, which was just infuriating people further. And then you even have Adawiya, who's asked about this, like, what were you singing about? And he's like, you know, stay silent. Let's people like assume either one. Right, and so that's one of the artists who's at the center of this idea of the vulgar soundscape and like the end of culture. But something to just note there with him too is like even people who were state sanctioned singers were so well aware of his popularity that at one point there's another photo in the book where they tried to co-opt him. Like two of the most important singers or kind of ruling regime endorsed singers in Egypt's history, where they would kind of criticize him publicly. But then he's performing at this hotel in London and one sends the other there. They were co-founders of a record label to basically try to like get him over to their label. And one of the ways they tried to do that is this singer ends up singing one of Adawiya's songs. He takes the stage with him. And this person in the audience snaps a photograph of it. That photograph makes its way back to Egypt and is published in one of those popular periodicals. And in response to that image, this is in the 70s, the guy comes out and says, I was never there. That never happened. And so we have like, this is something I tell students, like this is like fake news before fake news on social media. And so, you know, cassettes enable individuals like Adawiya, like Sheikh Hamam, and so many others to reach a mass audience for the first time ever. Whereas it would not have been possible for them to do that without this technology.
So in the final substantive chapter, you look at these cassette collections that still exist today and try to mine them. So where'd you go? Who'd you talk to? And what do you think these collections kind of have to teach us?
Yeah, so this is all about like what remains of Egypt's cassette culture. So, I mean, one of the places that I went was this electronic shop that used to be a cassette label. And so when I went in like 2015-16, it was selling like television remotes, extension cords. But then one of the entire walls of this little kiosk is cassette tapes, floor to ceiling. Many of those tapes have not made their way online. They are not preserved in any official repository or informal archive. They just continue to kind of linger in dust in this one kiosk. I mean, another example of this is I went to this Islamic Institute for Research, where I was basically saying, like, how did censorship work in the 70s and 80s? This is the one part that's kind of more on Islamic sounds. And they said, oh, censorship worked seamlessly. Like, we were able to control everything and who spoke in the name of Islam. And then I went to, like, primarily a record store in this area, Zemelek, this more upscale area in Cairo. And there were hundreds of cassette tapes there. And one of them was this collection, came from a single apartment in Cairo. And like 80% of the tapes did not have stamps of approval from that institute. And so clearly something different was happening in reality than opposed to in theory, or the image that they were trying to lend. So through kind of accessing these different collections, I think one of the things it raises is like, what makes its way into a library? What is excluded from that? And in excluding some things, what stories about the past do we foreclose? Mm-hmm. Like what things can we not tell? Because so often things that are preserved in archives, well, one, they're primarily texts or documents. But all of these materials, like they make a very different portrayal of the past possible. And so that, that was something that I was trying to think through. At the same time that we also have a cassette revival in the US and in other places.
Yeah, they're big again.
Yeah, I mean, Taylor Swift, everyone reissuing stuff on cassette tapes.
Yeah, exactly. So you, one of the things you try to do in the last section of the book is, you know, talk to a fellow Middle Eastern studies folks about, you know, some suggestions for roads forward with research. And I guess I should say, I mean, you do, is it right? You come from, like, that is your home, really, is kind of Middle Eastern studies. But you also draw on all these other fields, right? Sound studies and STSE type stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, you really draw on a lot of stuff. So, yeah, I mean, what did you want to say to your home field with this book?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, honestly, like, that I tried to do in this book is to write something that was also by no means like solely for scholars or even like Middle Eastern scholars. Like, I wanted to craft something that was engaging and to shed like a new light on something that people thought they knew. Like, one of the things I'm a big proponent of, like when it comes to teaching or like my own work, is to take something that is very ordinary and to try to show some extraordinary side of it. And so I think when it comes to this project, like a few things were of a main concern. Like, one of them was sound and the senses, like how we think about those things. Like, so often in the case of the Middle East or other places, we have almost very silent accounts of the past, which to me, like, pun intended, makes no sense, because like we, you know, apprehend everything around us in the present through all of our senses.
Right.
And so that's something that I wanted to bring like to this story. I think also, like, when it comes to mass media and popular culture, to really not look at like only the most recent media. Like, there's so many other media forms out there whose stories haven't been written. Like, the next project I'm going to do is going to be a transnational history of record culture across the Middle East. Like, moving from the times of like the Ottoman Empire, we're talking like pre-World War One to the present day. And so there's videotapes, there's so much more stuff to explore. And then pop culture, like, so often the focus is on artists who are like endorsed by people in positions of power that are like in bed with ruling regimes, that are singing in support of the government. I mean, think like country music post 9/11 in the US or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, like, I wanted to look at people that were challenging authorities and people that paid the price for doing that. And so that's something that I wanted to like honor and bring to the fore. And then like technology. Like you said, like, not just looking at like, oh, this thing was invented on this date by this engineer who was so brilliant and had this light bulb moment, and they're like predominantly male and predominantly white. Yeah. And so, like, I wanted to think about like what happens when all these things go elsewhere and all these people begin to use them. And then last thing's materials. Oh, yeah. Like, how do we tell a story of a place that whose rulers and leaders actively don't want us to do so?
On the technology front, I haven't checked in on it for a while, but there used to be this series, this is like early 2010s, called something like How the World Changed Social Media. And instead of How Social Media Changed the World. And it was a bunch of ethnographies of the adoption of social media in different parts, you know, all over the world. And it was just like a wonderful example of the kind of thing you're talking about, where it's like, I think there is a revolution, you know, in quotation marks, happening right now in technology studies, where we're seeing more and more studies of, you know, like Montaigne's study of like electricity in Mexico. I have a student looking at like satellite communications in Thailand. I think that's like something happening right now as people looking at how all these other places in the world adopt these systems.
Yeah. Yes, please. More of that.
And hell yeah. More, exactly.
I mean, like also in the case of the social media changing the world or vice versa.
Yeah.
I mean, something even in the case of like the Middle East is if we had all of that early rhetoric about, oh, like Facebook is inherently empowering or something, something that's come about more recently is like, oh, actually, all these authoritarian regimes are also using Facebook to identify protesters. Uh-huh. Like even with what's going on in Iran right now. And so all of these things being a double-edged sword and like really writing against technological determinism and then looking beyond the West.
Yeah.
And looking beyond the US and Europe, making it a global field of study.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean is the next book project the next project's this record thing? Tell us what you're up to now, man. Where are you going?
Yeah, so I'm pumped for that project. Basically, I have like several thousand documents and personal correspondence from the Gramophone Record Company, which ends up in Egypt during that kind of pre-World War I moment. And so it's going to begin with this...
Oh, Gramophone's like a big label, right? Like there's...
Yeah, like the little dog listening to the horn.
Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm flaking. Yes, of course.
And so looking at like, how can one write like a cultural history of British colonialism in Egypt in this moment? Because we have these unbelievable exchanges, like in these letters where you have these British officials at the peak of imperialism pre-World War One being like, we want to sell records to Egyptians, but don't they hate dogs because our emblem's a dog? And it's like, no, but like you read that because you're reading all this Orientalist stuff
written by your peers,
right? And so it's going to begin with that, but then it's going to move up to the present and looking at how people will actually travel to North Africa from elsewhere in the region and buy up like Egyptian culture and records to then keep in their private personal libraries.
Okay.
And so like what's going on with like record revival and cultural heritage, stuff like that.
Oh, that's interesting. So you have like hipsters and heads heading to Egypt and like developing like a world music collection. Is that the kind of stuff you see happening?
But like for themselves.
Okay.
Or even like older generations that are doing that, because that culture carries a certain currency. But then you also have like, you have people that are based in Europe, DJs.
Yeah.
People like Habibi Funk, other individuals that come to Egypt, record dive, and then end up reissuing songs that people never heard, or at least did not hear widely, remixing them. And so like this project, it's going to move from British colonialism to the European club scene, and then look at record culture more broadly.
That's cool. I mean, we should read one of these BASR studies of like radios in the Middle East, mid 20th century stuff, because I think it would be fun to see what sociologists were doing with that earlier stuff at some point. So
yes, making the Middle East modern or something through.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think like you have to set aside that shit, you know, because like that is boring as hell. But I think they were actually doing some interesting research, like interviewing people and stuff that would be worth examining.
Yeah, you know? I mean, I think totally. And I think too, I was even surprised to hear of that because there has been so little written on mass media that's not the internet or Al Jazeera when it comes to the Middle East. Like if we look at Europe or something, I mean, we have many books on something like history of radio. If you look at the Middle East writ large, you may have two histories.
Yeah.
And I know one that's being written right now.
Right.
I mean, I could count it on a hand. So there's a lot of stuff that needs to be done still.
Totally, man. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for taking the time today. I knew it would be fun. It was fun, dude. Thank you.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of our podcast. Peoples and Things, like most things in this world, depends on the work of many people. I want to thank my brother Jake Vinsel for writing the music for the show. I want to thank my buddy Juliana Castro for designing the logos for the podcast. Check out her work at julianacastro.co. Peoples and Things is a production of Virginia Tech Publishing and is supported by the Center for Humanities and the University Libraries at Virginia Tech. Production activities are hosted in the Athenaeum, a space in the library that acts as a hub for digital humanities teaching, learning, and creation. Joe Fort is the media production manager with Virginia Tech Publishing and serves as producer and sound engineer for Peoples and Things. Mandy Lamb is the production assistant. For information about other podcasts from Virginia Tech Publishing, visit publishing.vt.edu. I also want to thank you for listening. Thanks.